KIOS-FM presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Tuesday, June 11, 2002, for broadcast at this time. Today's special guest speaker will be Chicago Tribune columnist Bob Green, author of the best-selling book, Once Upon a Town, The Miracle of the North Platte Canteen. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Gary Kerr, co-chairman of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
Good afternoon. I'm Gary Kerr, co-chairman of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee. At least once a month, the Press Club sponsors a forum on a person or subject we think is of interest to our members and to the general public. These forums are open to the public. You do not have to be a Press Club member to attend. We welcome our audience here at the Press Club and our KIOS radio audience. And today we are privileged to have with us Chicago Tribune columnist Bob Green to talk about his new book, Once Upon a Town, The Miracle of the North Platte Canteen. And as you all know, the North Platte, Nebraska canteen was known among servicemen all over during World War II. A graduate of Northwestern University, Bob Green has worked at the Chicago Tribune since 1978. In his writings and commentaries, he focuses primarily on the ordinary lives and events that create the fabric of America. He has written 21 books. Bob Green will talk about his new book for 20 minutes or so, and then we will open it up to questions from our audience. And on your table is paper and pencil, so please write down your questions. Dale Munson is here, and he will pick up those questions and bring them to me to ask from the podium. So, ladies and gentlemen, Bob Green.
Thank you so much. Can you hear me in the back? This is my last day and night in Nebraska, at least for now, and it's just been, I didn't think any experience in Nebraska could compare to last year when I came to report on the canteen, but I'll tell you about it in a few minutes. It's just been wonderful. I wanted to find and write about the best America there ever was, and it seemed to me we're always looking for that, as if it's out in the distance somewhere in the future, that we have to have a focus group to sit down and try to find it. And it occurred to me that maybe it's not something we have to go chasing and find out there in the mists. Maybe we already had it and somehow threw it away. And that's why I came to North Platte. On Christmas night, 1941, the people of North Platte, at that time there were only 12,000 or so residents in North Platte, went down to the railroad station. In the 1940s, North Platte, the Union Pacific's main passenger line ran through North Platte, and the trains would all stop for 10 minutes, just 10 minutes, to take on water and other necessities. And, of course, when the war started, those trains turned into troop trains. So on Christmas night, 1941, the people of North Platte came down to the station on Front Street to give gifts to the soldiers, wish them Merry Christmas, and basically thank them. And then the next morning, the people came back, and they kept coming back. And from December of 1941 until April of 1946, when the soldiers had come home from the war, the people of that town of 12,000 people, from 5 in the morning till after midnight, every day, greeted, thanked, fed, danced with, played music for 6 million soldiers. 6 million of our fathers and grandfathers. It was a miracle. The subtitle of Once Upon a Town is The Miracle of the North Platte Canteen. I've never used the word miracle before in a book title, and I very seldom use it in text. Miracle's a strong, strong word. In this case, it applies. What happened in North Platte was a miracle. What happened was magnificent. There was no government money at all, no government supervision from the town of North Platte, from the state of Nebraska, or from the United States of America. The only federal money that came to the North Platte canteen was a $5 bill that President Roosevelt sent from the White House because he heard what was happening and he wanted to help. My idea was to come to North Platte, and the one thing I knew was that I would have to get there before it was too late, because the men and women of the canteen years, the soldiers who came through for 10 minutes at a time, and the women, mostly women, who helped them out and befriended them at the train station are now in their 70s and 80s and 90s. I didn't know quite what I was looking for, but as I say, the idea was, I think there was a chance the best America was right there. When I got to North Platte, the first thing I realized, I went down to the train station on Front Street, and of course there is no train station on Front Street. In the early 1970s, the Amtrak took over the rails and decided that the main passenger route through Nebraska, the one route, would not stop and would not pass through North Platte anymore. And 2 years later, the Union Pacific Railroad, having no use for the passenger depot anymore, tore it down. So now, when you go to Front Street, you realize this is going to be like looking for a ghost. But at the Lincoln County Historical Museum in North Platte, you know, at weddings they have those ledger books to sign in. You sign your name. Stacks and stacks of these big ledger books. But it wasn't for a wedding. They were put out in the train station during the war. And the soldiers would come through, and this was before the ballpoint pen era. So you'd see in very neat fountain pen, they would sign their names and hometowns. And I wondered as I looked at those, if they only had 10 minutes to come in and be catered to, why would they stand in line? Why would they spend any of those 10 minutes signing in? And, of course, it occurred to me that a lot of those guys, boys really, late teens, early 20s, didn't know that whether they would ever come home from the war. And so perhaps they were thinking that if they signed their name in hometown, maybe someday someone would know they were there. And as I looked at the ledgers, I knew that they were right, because someday someone, me, knew they were there. I was looking at those names. I knew it would be easier to find the women from the canteen than it would the men. The women who volunteered, of course, lived in West Central Nebraska, and there was a chance that they would have stayed around West Central Nebraska. So finding the volunteers all these years later was sort of relatively easy. It was harder to find the soldiers because they were only there for those 10 minutes. But I did find them. And what happened, when I spoke with the women, they were very emotional about the canteen, but they could get through the stories. They could go through them in a linear manner. The men, who had been there for the 10 minutes, at some point during our conversations, they would fall silent, and they would begin to cry, because they said what happened in North Platte, what happened in Nebraska, was the kindest that anyone treated them the entire war. They told me that on the battlefields of Europe and the Pacific during World War II, soldiers, guys who didn't even know each other, would turn to each other and say, "How would you like to be back in North Platte right now?" North Platte meant something to all those soldiers. The stories I heard, there was a soldier named Jack Mannion. And like a lot of the soldiers, you know, he ran into the canteen, he had 10 minutes of food and friendship and free magazines and gifts. But when he got back on the train, he was thinking that they got a little depressed when they got back on the train, because this wasn't going to happen again. It just happened in North Platte, and then here started the long, lonely ride again. But he had told his mother and father that he would be passing through Kearney that day. You weren't allowed to talk about exact troop movements, but you were allowed to say, "Well, I may be near Kearney on a certain day." So all that day, his mother and father waited by the railroad tracks in Kearney. And they waited as all the trains rolled in. And finally, here comes the troop train with young Jack Mannion on it. It was not going to stop in Kearney, but the conductor let him step onto the platform between the cars. And as the train rolled slowly through Kearney, Nebraska, his father, standing next to the track, reached his hand up, and Jack Mannion from the moving train reached his hand down, and their hands touched. And that's how father and son said goodbye to each other on the way to war from the North Platte canteen. I talked to one soldier who told me it was a 5-day trip across the country on those trains sometimes. And the guys, the men were filthy. They weren't allowed to shower because there were no showers in the trains. They shaved sporadically. They were sleeping 2 and 3 to a berth with strangers, eating cold field rations. And on the way across America, the older soldiers would say to the younger soldiers, "When we get to Nebraska, something great's going to happen." And the young soldiers thought that maybe their legs were being pulled, but that a practical joke was being pulled on them. And then they pulled into North Platte. And what this soldier said to me was that it wasn't so much the food, and it wasn't so much the gifts or the dancing or the magazines. He said, we pulled into North Platte after midnight, and we looked out the window of the train, and they were there. They were there. That's what he put the emphasis on. They were there. They never got over it. They never, 10 minutes, and they remembered it their entire lives. The women, I spoke to one woman. Again, this sort of sums up the spirit of the canteen, because the town of North Platte couldn't do it alone. 12,000 people could not feed 6 million people by themselves. So 125 communities from Nebraska around North Platte would volunteer to come in and help. And again, using their own ration coupons. If you had a ration coupon, you gave it to the canteen. Their own sugar. The sugar is very scarce. Give it to the canteen. If there was gasoline for that month, they would use it to drive into North Platte. In Sutherland, the group of women who would come in and help once or twice a month was called the Sutherland Ladies. And I met one of the Sutherland ladies who's now 70 or 80. And she told me one day at the canteen when she was working, there were 7,000 soldiers that day. They came in on 20 or 30 separate trains, 7,000 soldiers. And I said to her, did the soldiers that day know that it was the Sutherland Ladies' Day at the canteen? Did they know that it was your day? And she gently corrected me, and she said, no, they didn't think it was our day. It was their day. And that was the spirit of the canteen. It was their day. If there were 30 trains, each train load of those guys were made to feel that for those 10 minutes, they were the only people who mattered in the world. It was their day. I talked to one woman, a young girl at the time, who said that she would, when she would volunteer to the canteen, she would go out on the platform with the soldiers to say goodbye after each trainload ran out of the canteen, and she said, I would pray for them. And I said to her, did they know you were praying? And she said, no, because if they had turned around on their way back onto the train and they had seen me praying, they would have known that I was praying for their lives, and I did not want them to think about that. So I smiled and waved goodbye to them. I was praying with my eyes open. You would meet these people time and again and talk to them and hear their stories time and again. It was, as those of you who have read Once Upon a Town know, the voices of the men and women are the heart of the book, the sort of spine, the framework of the book. I went to North Platte and wandered through the town trying to draw comparisons of North Platte then and now, and in fact, of America then and now, because this country has changed profoundly in the 60 years. Among other things, soldiers going to war now, if you have to get to either coast to get on a ship, you fly across the United States. We pass each other 5 miles in the air. On a cloudy day, when you fly above North Platte, Nebraska, you don't even know the town is there. You can't see down. So it's different. We hope the spirit still remains, but it feels very different now. When you go to I-80, because when I came to Nebraska, my idea to the publisher said, what kind of tour do you want to do? You know, Los Angeles, New York, all that. I said, no, I want to get on I-80 in Denver, and I want to stop in the same towns that the trains pass through, because it looks very different now. The interstates weren't built until Eisenhower came into office after the war. To pass through these towns one at a time, I wanted to see the same thing the soldiers saw, and that's what I've been doing for this last week. It has been an honor to tell this story. Little things, this would never happen today, but when the soldiers would get back on the trains, the volunteers would give them popcorn balls that they had made in North Platte, and in the middle of the popcorn balls, there were little pieces of white paper. And the volunteers would have written the names and addresses of the young women and girls in the town. So the high school girls. So the soldiers could write them letters, had become pen pals during the war. I found two women in North Platte who had married the soldiers from the popcorn balls. The soldiers had written to the girls had written back, and they didn't meet till after the war. The soldiers came home from the war and met the girls they had corresponded with, and they got married. And the husbands are both now dead. The wives are still living. And one of them said to me, one of these women said, you know, I was never a very brave girl. and I don't know if I ever would have met anyone. But I had a husband and children and a wonderful life, all because of the North Platte Canteen. I have to tell you that all during this trip to Nebraska, I mean, those of us who write stories for a living, you don't always please the people you write about, and that's not what we're here for. And you don't get thanked by the people you write about. All across Nebraska, because what it comes down to, the men and women from the canteen years, what they have told me is that their one fear was that they would pass away and the canteen and what happened there would never be remembered, that they would die, and that little piece of Front Street in North Platte in Nebraska, no one would ever know what happened there. And there's no, as I mentioned, there's no train station there anymore. And the tracks, by definition, are on the wrong side of the tracks. People don't go down there. The men and women will all be gone sooner rather than later. But these people, these magnificent men and women, deserve a monument. And I hope that that's what Once Upon a Town will serve as. I hope the stories they tell, their voices, I hope that will be their monument. Because I know for sure now, on my way into North Platte, I got a call saying that Once Upon a Town had gone onto the New York Times bestseller list after 1 week of publication. I've never had a book go on that quickly before. So what I know for a fact now is that what happened there will never be forgotten. 100 years from now, people who want to, if people are still reading books, people will be able to tell what happened and hear it in their voices. As I've gone across Nebraska at some of the, I've just been so moved by the crowds, the turnout. I mean, look at this, you know. And people have come up to say thank you for writing the book, and I stopped them right away. Because the thanks goes to Nebraska. The thanks goes to the people of that town. I just came here and listened to the stories and wrote the story. The thanks now and forever go to the people of the North Platte Canteen and go to the people of Nebraska, because it didn't happen anywhere else. It could have any place. It could have happened any place had they made the effort and gotten the idea. It happened in North Platte. It happened in Nebraska. And I'm honored you would have me. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob Green. Alrighty. All right. Questions? And I'm just getting some as we speak here. Tell us about the popcorn balls. We're hiding you behind the...
behind the canteen. I think I just told you about the popcorn balls, but they did indeed give them out. They would make them themselves with, you know, this sticky sugar water. And they would put them together, and they didn't all have the women's names in them, but some did. And it was the soldiers knew they were going to get the balls. In fact, I talked to one girl. She's not a girl. She's 80 now in a wheelchair, you know. But her name's Doris Dotson, and she used to dance with all the guys on the platform. She would come down from school and do the jitterbug with these guys for their 10 minutes. And she collected a jacket with patches on them. And she would say to a guy, you know, look at my jacket. And they would say, well, you don't have the best insignia yet. You don't have the best insignia yet. And so three or four days later, she would get an insignia from another military unit. So it was the popcorn. And actually, she said that her dad finally had to paint their mailbox red because they had the hottest mailbox on North Platte because she was getting all that mail.
How many soldiers have returned to North Platte to visit since World War II?
Most don't come back to visit. North Platte, I can tell you, is not the easiest place in the world to get to, and most people don't go there on the way to somewhere else. What has happened over the years, though, which, again, just about melts you, just about makes you cry, is that people over the years have mailed thank you notes to North Platte, not to a person because they don't know any names, not to the mayor because the mayor, of course, is of a newer generation. There are scrapbooks and scrapbooks of thank you notes sent to North Platte, Nebraska. In fact, toward the end of the book, one of the chapters mentions a guy. He was a soldier during the war, and he came back. And in the 1970s, he was on a cross-country trip, and he was driving back, and he told his wife he wanted to stop in North Platte. And they stopped in North Platte and stopped at a Perkins restaurant. And the waitress was about 18 years old. And he said to her, "You ever hear of the North Platte Canteen?" And she said, "Yeah, I think my parents went there. Well, I think they worked there and volunteered." He said, "Well, you tell your parents thank you." And he told me, you know, there wasn't much there. I could tell that she was bored. She didn't know what the canteen really was. And I don't think she ever told her parents. And we got on I-80 and went on our way. And he said, "I've kicked myself ever since." He said, "Because I always wished I would have gone into North Platte and just thanked someone. Even if I just went to the Chamber of Commerce building, that's all I ever wanted to do, thank somebody." And that was one of the ways I helped find the soldiers, because they had written to the town thanking. And now, of course, there's the Internet. Now, Keith Blackledge, to whom the book is dedicated, the retired editor of the North Platte Telegraph, who helped me do my research and introduced me to people, he led me to a website where soldiers have sent thank you notes electronically, sometimes not signing their names. So here we are, you know, talking to the soldiers of 1942, emailing them at their email addresses and finding out when we can talk. I mean, the media have changed and the means of communications may have gotten more sophisticated, but the heart of it is still the same.
Humorous event. This person wants to know, what's the most humorous that occurred during the canteen years that you can think of?
Uh-oh, stand-up, huh? There's a kid named Slattery. I talked to him the other night. Again, he's not a kid. He's a 75-year-old rancher. But he was a young boy during the war years, and he lived in the western part of Nebraska. And he went. His dad was a rancher, and he went to a livestock auction once, and they sold some livestock. And then he took the shirt. He took his shirt off, and he sold his shirt to the crowd. And then he gave the money to the North Platte Canteen. And he kept doing it the entire war. And he would sell his shirt, they would pay him for it, and then they'd toss his shirt back. And so he kept the same shirt for the entire war. He would sell his shirt, you know, and then they'd say the highest bidder gets it. He'd take his shirt off, give it to the guy, and the guy would toss the shirt back to him. Made thousands and thousands of dollars for the North Platte Canteen, selling the shirt off his back. And the odd thing is, I've seen his picture as a young boy, you know, selling his shirt. And when he walked up to me the other night in North Platte, I said, "You're Slattery." Same face, no, same guy. I said, "Keep your shirt on."
Where did the idea for the canteen come from? Was there one person, a group?
There was a woman named Ray Wilson, R-A-E, Ray Wilson. She was the sister of a captain in the Nebraska National Guard, Company D. He was Captain Denver Wilson. And she had heard, or 10 days after Pearl Harbor on December 17th, she had heard that the Nebraska National Guard's Company D was on its way through town to war. And they came down to the tracks. And they greeted Company D. Well, it was Company D, all right, but it was Company D of the Kansas National Guard. But they decided they were still American boys, even though they weren't Nebraska boys or North Platte boys. And they gave the gifts and thanks and food to those Kansas guys instead. And the next day she wrote a letter to the editor, I think it was the North Platte Bulletin, not the Telegraph, so it's a paper that's now gone, saying, "We went down to the depot last night and gave our love to Company D of the Kansas National Guard. We can do this. If we can't do anything else to help with this war, we can do this. Let's set up a canteen." And the North Platte Bulletin ran the letter, and on Christmas night they went down for the first night as a real group, doing it on purpose, and they never stopped. One woman who wrote a letter to her paper, who printed it the next morning, and a miracle happened. One woman, Ray Wilson.
Again, let me mention, Dale Munson is here with to pick up any questions that you might have. Please give them to him, and he'll get them to me, and we'll ask them. Was there anything comparable anywhere else in the United States?
There were other canteens. There were big ones. You've heard of the stage door canteens. You've heard in New York and Los Angeles. There were Red Cross canteens, and there were some very nice canteens across the country. Virtually all of them charged the soldiers at least a little bit for what was in there. The soldiers, what I was told is the soldiers in North Platte, they would run off the train, run in, and again, stacks of sandwiches, cold bottles of milk, cookies, free magazines for them, everything free. And the first thing they would say is, "What do I owe you?" And the women would say, "You don't owe us anything." There were all kinds of, I mean, America was nice to its soldiers during World War II, but what the North Platte Canteen did, absolutely free, every train, never missed a train, never missed a soldier, every day of the war. That was singular. That was unique. And the reason you know that is that all these years later, as well as in the war, when the soldiers remember how they were treated, three words, North Platte Canteen. As a reporter, as you know, many of you know, you call people up, sometimes they don't want to talk. Especially when you're calling people colds in their 70s and 80s and even 90s, and you're calling from Chicago, they may not be that eager to have a conversation. Three words. I'm calling to talk about the North Platte Canteen. You know about the North Platte Canteen? How much time do you need? They couldn't do more. They still want to say thank you.
You mentioned gifts. Did any soldiers still have them as keepsakes?
I haven't talked to soldiers who have the things that were literally given to them at the canteen. The gifts were of magazines, Bibles, sometimes little trinkets. I mean, they weren't things of value. The gifts were the food, the current issue of Life magazine that the people had brought for their farm so the soldier could take it on the train. The magazine companies weren't donating these thousands of magazines. The families in West Central Nebraska were bringing them in. So, yeah, the gifts were not of great monetary value, and I have not spoken to a soldier who has said he still has an actual gift. What they have is the memory behind the gifts.
Between your book, Brokaw's book, and others, why the resurgence in interest in World War II?
There are a lot of reasons. Maybe it comes down to honor thy father and thy mother. I mean, I think it might come back down to that. I mean, you can come up with all kinds of historic reasons why there may be a resurgence in interest, but as this generation is leaving us, we finally realize whatever we may accomplish in our lives, you know, you hope we do well. What they did, coming through the Depression and saving the world, and then coming home and not bothering their children with it. It's almost as if the sort of leave it to beaver stereotype world of the 1950s was one of the fruits of victory of World War II, and that our parents, who went through the anguish of the Depression and then there are no words to describe what they went through in World War II, decided they would give to us the opposite of that. They would give us this facade of a world with no problems. And we may be late in expressing our appreciation for that, but you know, another cliche, better late than never. And I think that's what this has a lot to do with. We are realizing that whatever we may do, it'll never be better than what they did.
A number of questions about how you got interested in the story. How did you first hear of this story? How many people did you interview? How did you learn of the North Platte Canteen? How did you decide to write about it? Are you familiar with other books about the North Platte Canteen? How'd you find out about it? How become interested in the story?
Could you repeat the question? my column appears. I have to amuse myself up here. My column appears in the North Platte Telegraph. And about 10 years ago, I received a letter or a phone call from North Platte. The Lincoln County Historical Museum was having a fundraising, trying to improve their museum, and the person from North Platte asked me if I could help them with a column. I usually can't do that for papers around the country that carry the column, but in this case, for whatever reason, I was able to do it, and I didn't go to North Platte. I did the talking on the telephone, but in the back of my mind, I never forgot that obviously, in hearing about the museum in North Platte, I learned about the canteen, and in the back of my mind, I never really forgot what I had heard, and I always meant to get there. And then about a year ago this winter, I was having these thoughts about the best America there ever was, and I thought, what was that train station? What was that story out in the middle of the country? And I called Keith Blackledge, who now is retired, he's 75, and he urged me to come to North Platte and see for myself. Well, this was in February. So I told him I'd come, but I'd wait till the sun was a little higher in the sky, which also was a mistake, because in July there, it was like you melt into the blacktop. But Keith suggested I come there. And when I got there, it only took me about 20 minutes to realize, boy, this is more than a newspaper column. Because, I mean, I'll tell you, we talked about the building being gone, the canteen building. As a reporter, especially now, knowing what I know, because I was just back to North Platte over the weekend, standing at those Union Pacific tracks now, when there's no depot and there is no visitor center, it's more emotional and more evocative for me than if they built some sort of visitor center there. I stand, because the fact is, let's face it, without a passenger railroad, if you put some sort of structure down by the tracks, it doesn't make a lot of sense. To stand there now in the emptiness, because there's a little plaque and there's this flagpole and a little planting of plants, but hence the name. But if you stand there now in the emptiness down there, because the tracks are still there, same exact place, right? Yeah. I feel it more than if they had something there that they tried to reconstruct. I stand by those tracks and I can hear the trains coming in. And I stand by those tracks and I can hear the music coming from the canteen. I can see the soldiers running off the track. I mean, I stand there and I'm at the canteen. I can hear the music playing. You can feel it. And already, as the people who have read Once Upon a Town are sending me emails and letters, so many people are saying, I want to go to North Platte. And I hope they will. Because I hope the town doesn't build something right there. I hope they just commemorate it and keep it clean. Because to stand right there. You're at the canteen. This was a love story. This was a love story between a country and its sons. And you stand there, and you're right there. I mean, I don't think that was the case around the country before the book, because people didn't know to go there. But if you read these stories, and you go down, and you stand there, it moves you. It's remarkable. And I would suggest any of you who go through North Platte, get off I-80 and go down to Front Street and take a right. You won't regret it.
How many people did you interview?
I don't even like to call them interviews for this book. They were conversations. Probably 60 or more full-length ones of the men and women I was able to find. But as you know from reading, if you look at Once Upon a Town, there's a large acknowledgement section in the back where I tried to thank everybody who I spoke to or who helped me out by helping me understand the tone of the town. People who weren't mentioned in the book, but people who helped me understand what Nebraska and North Platte meant then and now. The little things they did, a stranger can't come into a town like that and expect to write the story without the goodwill of the people in the town. And I cannot I can't imagine any reporter being treated with more kindness than I was. Little things. The guy who runs the local photocopy shop in North Platte drove his machine, his photocopy machine, down to the Lincoln County Museum because there is none there. So the entire time I was there, I could copy everything I was seeing. So all the documents, all the letters from the soldiers, the bank book, the ledger that they had from the canteen, the ledger books I told you where they signed in, the newspapers of the era. If I had to do it by hand, I'd still be sitting down there. You know, I took an extra suitcase with me to Nebraska, and I carried back with me all this copies from the North Platte canteen. And it was because this one guy was nice enough to say, I'll bring my copier down there. You can have it while you're in town. And the reason I think that happened was because of the love of North Platte and the love of Nebraska and just the intuitive sense on their part in that town that this story should be told so the whole world knows about it.
Are you familiar with other books about the canteen?
There are several books in which the canteen has been mentioned. There's a lovely little photo, I don't want to know if it's a book or a pamphlet. It's not very long, but it's really evocative by a guy named James Reisdorf, who I met when I was in North Platte, which is a lot of photos from the canteen. But actually, the photos were provided by my friends here from the Union Pacific Railroad. The cover of Once Upon a Town, the jacket photo, is of, well, you'll see it, of soldiers on the train. And National Public Radio last week, Bob Edwards on Morning Edition interviewed me, and they were so moved by the story that up on the NPR website, they have posted the Union Pacific provided photos so people around the country can see them. So they're in Nebraska. Well, it's funny, though. I was about to say in Nebraska, this is no secret. And that's the thought I had all along. The rest of the country should learn about this because Nebraska already knows. I was surprised how many people in Nebraska really didn't know about the North Platte Canteen. I thought it would be taught in every school. I thought it would be one of the first things you learned in school in Nebraska. So there have been, I mean, like I say, Jim Reisdorf's photo book is a lovely lovely compilation of photos. But as far as a full length book about the, of reporting about the North Platte Canteen, I'm not aware of anything.
Give us a sense of what these soldiers got when they got their food, drank, that kind of thing.
Well, they would run off the train, and the younger girls, not younger, but, you know, the older teenage girls of the town, the homecoming queens and cheerleader types, you know, they were called platform girls, and they would greet the soldiers. They would greet the soldiers. So the first thing the soldiers would see pleased them. And then they would go into the canteen where the people their mother's ages would have been cooking and making the sandwiches. There were these huge platters of sandwiches. If you see pictures of them, where did it come from? Where did it come from? There was no food. There was no materials available for this. They made them every day. And there's a piano in the corner. And always, you know, one soldier or sailor who knew how to play would sit down and play the piano. Amazing stuff. There's a picture. The Union Pacific has the picture of a skinny young sailor named Lloyd. Is it Sinovec? Am I pronouncing it right? Sinovec. He stopped for 10 minutes, bangs on the piano, and over the piano is a caricature of Hitler looking down because this is the enemy, and he was up there in the canteen. This is who we're fighting. I'd seen the picture a million times. There was a softball tournament in North Platte while I was reporting the story, and the team's youth softball tournament, and the teams and their parents were staying at the same hotel I was. And on Saturday night, because there's not a whole lot to do in North Platte on Saturday night, the parents asked me if I wanted to come out to the softball complex. So I went out late in the afternoon, a very steamy, hot afternoon, watched the game. And on my way out of the Dow Hauer softball complex, I see the guy I'd bought my ticket from. It cost like a couple bucks to get in. And I look at him. It's Lloyd Sinovec, the sailor from the picture. He had moved to North Platte, and here he was 60 years later standing in the heat still helping out with the town. So anyway, they would go into the canteen. Their food would be there, the music, the magazines. Every train, this is, again, every train for the entire war, let's say there were 30 a day for 5 years, every train got its own freshly baked birthday cake. They would bake them in North Platte, and the train would pull in, and the ladies would come out and say, whose birthday is it? And, of course, if there were more than 365 people on the train, likely it was someone's birthday. But on those trains where there was no one's birthday, they would say, Captain, we're making it your birthday. And unlike most birthday cakes, the ones we're used to, the difference was there was no name on the icing on top because they didn't know who they were baking the cakes for. Think of that. Their own sugar, their own eggs, their own flour, their own time, a fresh birthday cake for every train of World War II, and they didn't know who they were baking it for. So they'd be in there for 10 minutes, and then they would run off the train and run back onto the platform and get back onto the train and pull away. But, of course, at the canteen, they knew that in a little while there'd be another one. And the next group would pull in, and those guys would be made to feel that they were the only people in the world.
A lot of the trains came through. Some got off. Some were not able to get off. Do you know how many people actually got off the train and actually were able to get into the canteen, and how many just had to stay on a train because it was moving through so fast?
Well, the trains virtually always stopped. Sometimes the commanding officers in the trains wouldn't let the guys get off. But on those trains, the women would get on. And on these trains, like the platform girls weren't allowed on. But the older women would get on and go down the aisles and give away the things. And they said that the thing that really broke their hearts was the hospital trains, because the hospital trains would come through, and the canteen volunteers were not technically allowed to go on there, but they did. They had to take their shoes off and to see close up these guys just torn up by the war coming home. But the trains, the guys weren't allowed to get off. The women got on and gave them the gifts. The trains never went unmet. I mean, they would hate. I've seen film footage of the ladies passing the food and gifts up through the train windows for the soldiers who weren't allowed to get off. No, you're there. That's right. I'm not used to this.
I don't know the context in which this is asked, but I'll read the question anyway. Were you relieved no one entered the bikini contest you and the nurses attended?
Okay, raise your hand who asked that question. Okay. Shame on you. Now, there's a chapter in the book. I thought I would go looking for vice in North Platte. And the reason was, North Platte, I discovered before World War II, was a pretty wide-open town. I mean, it came to being because the Union Pacific Railroad gang stopped there for the winter. That's why North Platte was built. They set up camp there for the winter as they built the tracks. There were, you know, houses of prostitution. There was gambling. It was known as a little Chicago at one point in the 20th century. There'd be bodies out in the fields. The canteen pretty much changed all that. Front Street became a place of wholesomeness and patriotism instead of a place of brothels and, you know, and gambling and drinking. But I, just in the interest of balanced reporting, I wanted to see if there was still any vice left in North Platte. And I mean, there were no casinos or strip bars or topless joints. I mean, I looked in the yellow pages. There was nothing like that. No game. But I was coming back, either down Jeffers or Dewey one night, and I saw a sign that says Touchdown Club, $1,500 bikini contest tonight. I didn't know what it was, but I figured it would be the closest thing to vice in North Platte. But I also knew that I couldn't go skulking around there by myself. You know, I'm a stranger in town hanging out at the bikini contest. So every morning I'd been walking around town down one street and around. I would pass the Great Plains Regional Medical Center every morning on my walk on my way up and back. So I met a couple nurses, and I had told them about this bikini contest and how I was reluctant to go there by myself. And they said, well, we'll take you, you know. And they told their husbands and families they'd be home late. So we pull in. Well, no, I mean, you know. I'm just telling you how I reported the book. So we pull into the Touchdown Club, and I'm expecting, you know, Las Vegas, Midwest. And we walk in, and it's, you know, it's a Husker sports bar, you know. You know, it's a sports bar. It's a University of Nebraska-themed sports bar, and there's like, it's the girls' softball team's having dinner. But there is a stage, but there's nothing on it, and the time came and passed. We're having some beers. And we said to the waitress, is the bikini contest supposed to start? And she said, we got to wait for the softball girls to finish their dinner. I said, oh, it's a good idea, actually. So we waited, and they left with their bats and gloves, you know. And then the lights go down, and the big beat music goes up, and the spotlights are crossing the stage, and the bikini contest starts, and no one enters. And we wait 45 minutes, and no one enters. And so all of a sudden, this guy's going around with a legal pad. One of the guys who runs the place is going around asking women in the would they like to enter. No one's entering, you know? And the nurses say to me, you know, we're really sorry. I said, sorry, this is great. This is exactly what it should be, you know? So the guy finally comes up to the table and says to the two nurses, $1,500 in this contest, would you like to enter? And the ones with me laughs. I'm 41 years old. My kids are waiting for me to come home and put them to bed. So we waited and waited, and no one entered the contest. And they drove me home, and again, home, the Quality Inn. And again, you know, they said, we're really sorry no one enters. Do you think anyone ever enters the contest? And we figured it out that maybe the reason they can offer $1,500 for the winner is that no one's going to enter. So thank you for asking that very wholesome question.
Why did the railroad tear down the depot?
It's a matter of some bitterness in the town, I must say, even with my friends from the Union Pacific here. The people of the town didn't want it torn down. And the phrase around North Platte, whether it's literally accurate or not, is it was torn down in the middle of the night. There is some thought that the railroad tore it down just so there would never be a chance for the passenger railroads to come back. The amazing thing about North Platte, the place where there are no trains, and it's the next to last chapter in the book, and it's the one so many people are commenting on. In the town where there's no more trains, passenger trains, in the town where you can't come as a passenger to arrive in North Platte, just to the north and west of the main city, in a place you can't get in without a security pass, is something called the Bailey Yard. And the Bailey Yard, in the city with no passenger trains, is the biggest railroad yard in the world. Imagine O'Hare Airport or Hartsfield International set down in North Platte and no one talks about it around the country. If you go up to 1,000 people on the streets around the United States and say, what's the Bailey Yard? Unless they're railroad people, they won't know. Deloitte Young, who was the retired manager of yard operations, took me out there and got me past the security. You've never seen anything like it in your life. There are towers like airport control towers, and you climb up in them, and you look out there, and all you can see is railroad tracks. It's 8 miles long. The people who worked there have figured out that if the University of Nebraska football team was to play its games in the Bailey Yard, there would be room for 3,000 football fields inside the Bailey Yard. The reason it's there, again, people don't think about it, but think about it. If a train's going from Los Angeles with cars in the back of it, with cargo for Detroit in one car and St. Louis in another and Cleveland in another and Dallas in another, the engineer can't be like a mother in an after-school carpool and just drop them off. You know, the cars, am I saying this right? That's how I thought of it. The cars have to be switched. So what it is called a classification yard. They switch the cars from the trains that brought them there to the trains that will take them to their ultimate destination. But they have to do it quickly because this is, you know, time is money. 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. There's a hotel, a motel on North Platte that the Union Pacific keeps 100 rooms, pays for them full time, that are used 3 times a day. The guys come in, sleep. The housekeepers change the sheets. I think they change the sheets. Full time, 100 rooms, and there's a locomotive repair shed. You can't believe this place. This is this huge locomotive repair shed, full time, all year round, servicing locomotives, not just the UP locomotives, but locomotives from other railroads go there. It's this huge, huge operation, the biggest railroad yard in the world, with not a railroad passenger to be found. Not a railroad passenger to be found. It's astonishing. But there's no depot because there are no passengers.
Bob, I think you addressed this briefly before. I'll ask it again. Is there any effort being made by the North Platte community to memorialize the train station site?
At the site, there is a plaque commemorating what happened there. And again, this will break your heart. As the canteen closed down, the board, the women who were on the board that ran the canteen, decided in 1946 that none of the money that was left over should be used for a memorial plaque. They agreed that there should be a plaque, but they didn't want to use the donated money because they said that was intended for the soldiers. So they took all the remaining money and gave it to veterans hospitals in Lincoln and in Denver. But a plaque eventually was put up. There are two flagpoles with an American flag and a Union Pacific flag, I believe, and there is a planter. Sorry to say, as of my last trip to North Platte, there's graffiti all over the back of the wall that holds the plaque. Whether they will do anything now, you know, I don't say this facetiously, I hope they start making jackets and T-shirts. You know, the North Platte canteen name's going to mean something again, and the world's not going to all come to North Platte, but I hope they do sell stuff with the name North Platte Canteen on it, just so, you know, better North Platte Canteen than the name of some rap or rock group, you know? I mean, I would see nothing wrong with, to use that terrible marketing word, with merchandising the North Platte Canteen on the part of the people of North Platte, because it's magnificent, you know? Nothing to be ashamed of, something to be proud of. But in terms of building the Lincoln County Historical Museum, which is a very modest and unassuming place, like the town itself, has all kinds of memorabilia, but I can tell you it's never going to be Disney World, you know? It's not that. It's a town's preservation of its history. But in terms of something to draw people in, though, there's nothing.
Could you talk about the last train at the canteen?
Who asked that question? Thank you. Because will this be our last thing, too? Okay. I was going to end with that anyway. Thank you very much. It had to end sometime. And it had been determined that, after the war ended and they kept it open, because on VJ Day, a glorious day in America, exuberance, happiness, and in North Platte too, but they also knew that something was going to change. The greatest thing this town ever did was going to stop. And they decided to keep it open for the guys coming home. But by early 1946, it became clear there was not quite the same sense of urgency. It didn't feel like they were doing something that mattered quite so much. And they decided that a certain day in April of 1946 would be the last day of the canteen. And on that day, there were three women remaining, and they were mopping up, literally. They were mopping the floors, putting the equipment away, getting ready to lock up for good. And they made themselves, at the end of their cleanup, these three ladies made themselves a pot of coffee to relax and lean back. And here comes a train. And they weren't troop trains by then. They were passenger trains on which soldiers were riding. And 11 soldiers were among the civilians on that train. And the soldiers came into the canteen. And they were told that the canteen had just closed. And one of the soldiers said, "It's okay if you close the canteen. You've earned enough points for your honorable discharge." At which point, the women gave the soldiers their pot of coffee.
Before we wind up here, this questioner wants to know if there's any in the audience who went through the North Platte Canteen as soldiers. Anybody? Got any raised hands? Hey, here we go. One, two, three. Three hands raised. Fantastic. And this questioner says, "I am sitting next to a lady who worked at the canteen. Would that lady who worked at the canteen stand up? Raise your hand. Where is she? Hey, stand up. Come on." Thank you very much for working at the canteen. Before we end today, we have a presentation that we want to make to you, Bob Green. And for that, let me introduce Judy Monahan, the president of the Omaha Press Club.
Thanks, Gary. Again, I'm Judy Monahan and president of the club, and I want to thank you all for coming. Bob, if you'll stand up for just a second next to me here. The Omaha Press Club has a tradition based on the biblical teaching that a prophet is never really recognized in his or her homeland. I think we are the only press club in the country with this tradition. In fact, I'm pretty sure we may be the only press club in the country that has ever based her tradition on a biblical teaching. In any event, as a small token of our appreciation for your appearance here today, the press club would like to bestow on you the title of honorary prophet. Excuse me. This for you.
This will go great at airport security.
I was thinking the same thing. With this prophet staff, we acknowledge the inspiration you have given others by your example, and we thank you so much for being here with us today. Thank you, Bob.
Good luck with that. I know you're going to do it.
Thank you, Bob Green. Thank you to the audience here at the Press Club today. Thank you to our KIOS radio audience. We are adjourned.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. Today's guest speaker was Bob Green, Chicago Tribune columnist and author of the best-selling book, Once Upon a Town, The Miracle of the North Platte Canteen. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Tuesday, June 11, 2002, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Gary Kerr for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club holds these noontime educational forums each month. The next forum will be on Thursday, June 20th at 12 noon. The topic will be diabetes, treatments, research, and the future. The guest speakers will be Dr. James T. Lane, assistant professor in the Department of Medicine at the University of Nebraska Medical Center and nationally recognized diabetes expert, and Margaret Booman, medical reporter for KETV Channel 7 and an insulin-dependent diabetic. If you'd like to attend this or other future forums, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Coate, thanking you for listening.